تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام، چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی،
human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
وقتی شخصیت امیرالمومنین رو بشناسه در مقابل او خضوع میکند.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Ali is the need of our time, the 20th century. We need him now. Look at even the United Nations when they issued this famous report about the socio-economic, you know, situation in the Arab world, about the development there. They actually emphasize to the Arabs that we are not asking you to follow the West. Go back to your own sources and your own books. And then they have a quotation, a passage from Nahjul Balagha, the letter that Ali wrote to Malik Ashtar. They said, look at that. He's from your world. And follow that. And so my message to us, especially this year, is that how much do we know about Ali? How much do you know about the sayings of Ali and the lectures which are there, the sermons which are there in Nahjul Balagha? You know, Shaheed Murtaza Mutahiri has a very good statement in his brief commentary on Nahjul Balagha, where he says, we are like the salesman of the perfume who goes around, you know, sells the perfume, gives them, this is the, you know, sample version of it, use on yourself. Spreads the fragrance around. But if you look at himself, there is no smell there. We go around and talk about Ali. But have we taken that ilm and wisdom and knowledge of Ali, rubbed it on ourselves or not? We don't need, you know, non-Muslims to appreciate Ali and write about Ali, study his ideas and thoughts and then present to us. And then we say, MashaAllah, you know, Christians are saying this about Ali. What about us? Let us make a commitment with Ali ibn Abi Talib tonight. That at least from now on, we'll pick up Nahjul Balagha. And if you don't want to buy, don't worry about it. Online version is free. Go to the last segment of Nahjul Balagha, the sayings. Short sayings there. Make a point of reading and studying and pondering on one saying per week. And this is where you will come to realize who is Ali. And you will get closer to him and his ideas and his expectation that he has from his followers, and especially from his Shia.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Dozens of people gathered in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to mark Palestinian Prisoners' Day, a day when resistance factions and their supporters stand in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails.
On this day, which marks the Day of Palestinian Prisoners, I am certain that the people of the Arab and Muslim worlds, as we see in this gathering, will show the true unity with the resistance and the path of the resistance, especially with the issue of the prisoners and Al-Quds, which are the emblem of the Palestinian struggle.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem stressed that one cannot be truly with Palestine if they are not with the resistance.
It has become clear that whoever is with Palestine should be with the resistance. Anyone who has declared that he is with Palestine but hasn't taken one practical step in supporting the resistance is not truly with Palestine. Military resistance comes first. The other forms of resistance back and help to serve the actual resistance with arms.
He recalled that after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, late Imam Khomeini took the decision to close the Israeli embassy and reinstate the Palestinian embassy before declaring he was with Palestine. Liberating Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails has become a struggle for all resistance factions as it is linked directly to the Palestinian cause. They stress that liberating prisoners can only be realized completely by liberating Palestine. Officials of Palestinian resistance groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad considered that history has proven that only armed struggle can be a path to liberating both Al-Quds and the prisoners who continue to suffer from Israel's aggressive policies. More than 4,400 Palestinian prisoners are currently held in Israeli jails. Minors and women are among 500 detainees under the so-called administrative detention policy, under which they are held without charge or trial for an indefinite time period. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Italians have slammed Israel's continued pursuit of repressive, violent practices against Palestinians following the killing of several Muslims, including a teenage boy, by Israeli security forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, a major holy site in Al-Quds, last week. Tensions between Israelis and Palestinians have been running high over the past weeks, with Israeli forces carrying out numerous raids in the West Bank, which led to the deaths of a number of Palestinians. The latest round of violence by Israel on Monday saw its soldiers forcing their way into the Al-Aqsa Mosque and removing worshippers from its courtyards in order to allow settlers to exclusively mark the Passover holiday into the compound.
Once again, during Ramadan, a new aggression against Palestinians by the Israeli regime. This time they caught off guard men, women and children who were praying at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This again has shown the nature of the Israeli regime and the complacence of the international community.
Last year, during Ramadan, similar violence broke out, sparking the biggest conflict in years between Palestinian resistance movements and Israel, an 11-day war which only ended following intervention by international mediators. The violence against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds came at a particularly sensitive time. Ramadan this year coincided with the Christian Holy Week, which ends today, Monday, the second day of Eastertide. Catholic faithful have strongly condemned the latest killing of Palestinians by Israeli security forces.
For the umpteenth time, it is a provocation by Israel. This action were just a fresh provocation. There is a lack of respect for others' beliefs. During Eastertime and Ramadan, we have to be more thoughtful.
Tensions there are due exclusively to Israeli occupation policy. However, the international community seems to have lost interest in the conflict. By not taking any side, the Italian government is supporting Israel in practical terms.
Last meeting between Italian and Palestinian authorities took place in December when Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki met his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio on the sidelines of the 7th edition of the Rome-MED Dialogues Conference. Other than reiterating Italy's traditional support for the Palestinian Authority, Di Maio reaffirmed Italy's commitment to a just, sustainable and negotiated two-state solution between Palestine and Israel as the key to stability and prosperity in the enlarged Mediterranean. Max Civili, Rome.
People in the port city of Karachi hit the streets to voice their outrage at the ouster of the elected government. The protesters say the U.S. conspired against their country. While Imran Khan never sought sore ties with any nation during his short-lived premiership,
former Prime Minister Imran Khan has accused Biden administration in Washington for toppling his government in Pakistan, for not towing U.S.'s line on foreign policy.
Khan said that his life is in danger, but he prioritizes Pakistan's independence over his life.
Imran Khan had twice tweeted, or in fact more, but he had a clear message for the U.S. administration that we are partners in peace. We will always be partners in peace. We are partners in trade. We'll always be partners in trade with the whole world, with everybody. But we will not take dictation from anybody.
I'm here specifically to do my part in wanting and executing the Pakistan that we all want. And I think Imran Khan represents a vision of that Pakistan. And I personally, honestly think it's not his job alone to do this. It's our job, our responsibility to come out and do this for ourselves. That's why I'm here.
We've gathered here because of the sovereignty of Pakistan, and we want Pakistan to get justice and Imran Khan to get justice, and we don't believe in the fake government.
Khan says U.S. diplomats started meeting some Pakistani officials 4 months ago, adding that Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S. was threatened.
We've gathered here to fight for a more democratic Pakistan, to fight for a free and independent Pakistan, to fight for a Pakistan that doesn't get bullied. That is our main reason for being here, for standing up for Pakistan, its sovereignty, and its integrity.
We're just here to support Imran Khan in this freedom fight. We're here to just, we don't accept the imperial government. We're here to support our Prime Minister Imran Khan. He came here with the elected votes, our votes.
It's a protest for democracy. It's a protest for justice and for rights and human rights. The world, people choose their own leaders. Every citizen has a choice, has a right to choose their own people who they want to govern over them.
Khan has called for a snap election and urged an investigation into what he calls the U.S.'s plot to topple his government. He has become the first Pakistani prime minister to be removed from office through a non-confidence vote by the parliament. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
Palestinians rallied in the besieged Gaza Strip on Sunday to mark the 48th anniversary of Palestinian Prisoners' Day. Palestinian Prisoners' Day commemorates the first Palestinian prisoner exchange deal with Tel Aviv in 1974. Statistics show that Israeli forces have arrested nearly 1 million Palestinians since 1967. The rally was organized by all Palestinian factions who came together to express their solidarity with the prisoners in Israeli jails.
On Palestinians' Prisoners' Day, we call on all international organizations, especially the Red Cross, to fulfill their obligations towards Palestinian prisoners. The Red Cross has failed to protect Palestinian prisoners and has remained silent while Palestinian prisoners continue to suffer inside Zionist jails.
Israel currently holds around 5,000 Palestinians in its prisons and detention centers, including women and minors. Protesters shouted slogans against Israel and expressed their unwavering support for the prisoners.
For us, every day is a prisoner's day because Palestinian prisoners are our heroes and they live in our hearts and minds. We pray for them, especially during this holy month of Ramadan, to remain strong in the face of their Zionist captors.
Palestinian prisoners have gone on hunger strike several times in recent years to draw attention to their plight. Activists called on Palestinian armed wings to capture more Israeli soldiers in order to swap them with Palestinian prisoners.
Only capturing more Israeli soldiers can bring about the liberation of Palestinian prisoners. Armed resistance is the best option to help secure the release of the prisoners because our enemies only understand the language of force.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Palestinian prisoners continue to face a wide range of human rights violations in Israeli jails and detention centers. As they mark Palestinian Prisoner Day, people here accuse the international community of turning a blind eye to the continued Israeli crimes against thousands of Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The French presidential election was trending as an easy victory for the incumbent, Emmanuel Macron, until the unrest in Ukraine began. Macron's insistence on long-term sanctions for Russia exploded already high inflation. That's resulted in widespread hardship, resentment, and tough assessments of Macron's economic record.
It's clear that Macron has not improved the quality of life for the French. He's not responsible for all the problems he's had to deal with, but it's clear there's a big difference between what he's promised and what he's delivered.
The French election may come down to this. Who do voters feel will protect the average person from the economically explosive effect of long-term sanctions on Russia over the unrest in the Ukraine? It's not a question the mainstream media wants to discuss, but it is top of mind for the average person. Polls show the race is now a dead heat, with a soaring Marine Le Pen of the National Rally taking an opposite tack, promising to oppose Russia energy sanctions, which are wreaking havoc with gas, heating, and food prices. As the challenger, Le Pen doesn't have a record to defend, and she's escaping anger over the economic crisis.
Macron has absolutely not done a good job on protecting our purchasing power. The middle class feels that Macron has contempt for the middle class, and they also feel a great contempt for the neoliberal globalist banker Macron.
Macron's far-right economic policies provoked the unprecedented yellow vest protests in 2018. He only made minor concessions before turning to brutal repression. And the coronavirus crisis only aggravated economic inequalities.
Macron needed to go much further in his efforts to reduce prices. It's unbearable to go to the supermarket these days. Even people who make an honest salary say that they are having trouble.
Abstention may reach record highs because many voters wonder if Le Pen would actually deliver on her populist economic promises. Her party has historically been aligned with neoliberalism as well. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Ramadan 2022 is underway, and Muslims are fasting from dawn to dusk. But to those who are fasting for the first time, it is going to be the most different and memorable Ramadan. Tehran municipality has invited more than 800 first-time fasters to this iftar meal to celebrate their religious coming of age. In Islam, a person would be responsible to perform their religious tasks when they reach puberty. And that's when they're duty-bound to fast during Ramadan.
We invited 850 kids today to teach them that fasting is more than a duty, but a bliss. Here, they learn about the benefits of fasting when it comes to regulating their digestive system. And more importantly, they learn that fasting polishes their soul as it boosts their spirituality.
In Muslim societies, Ramadan is known as the month of God, and Muslims believe they're invited to a divine party. That's why in the holy month, humanitarian activities and charity works get supercharged, with people trying to do whatever they can to help the needy.
Muslims view Ramadan as not just a time to refrain from eating and drinking. They regard it as a chance to push the limits on humanity and become the best version of yourself as a human being. And that's what organizers here try to teach first-time fasters. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Tensions are high in the occupied territories amid a recent increase in crackdown on Palestinians. Regime forces attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque on Friday. Scores of Palestinians were wounded in the clashes. Around 400 people were also arrested. Muslim nations as well as resistance groups have condemned Tel Aviv. the Organization of Islamic Cooperation called on the international community to force Israel to end its aggression. Iran said Friday's events in Muslims' third holiest site show that the Palestinian resistance is alive and thriving, and Israel is in a state of desperation. Analysts believe that Tel Aviv is intentionally increasing tensions to take control of Al-Aqsa Mosque.
I think that the Israelis are escalating the whole situation in the West Bank in order, at least in Jerusalem, in order to control the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that was the aim for the settlers groups who announced many times that they wanted, to get into Al-Aqsa Mosque and practice some of their own religion kind of practices. If they did such an act, definitely that would lead to a war.
The clashes came after 3 weeks of deadly tensions in the occupied territories. Tel Aviv has deployed more forces to the West Bank and conducted raids and house searches there almost every day. This has resulted in the deaths and injuries of dozens of Palestinians. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has given Israeli forces a free hand in their operations. Many believe that the latest escalation could turn into an uprising or a new intifada in Palestine.
Palestinian experts are warning that they could return back, let's say, to more clashes, more escalation. These killings by the Israeli forces and this escalation could anytime turn into an uprising or an intifada. No one can tell, especially that the Israelis are saying they will not end their operation. It will continue.
Palestinians have also increased their operations in response to the crackdown. Since March 22nd, they have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations, including one in Tel Aviv, leaving 14 Israelis dead. The increase in anti-Israel operations in the occupied territories show that Palestinians have reached a conclusion that they should decide their own fate, especially after several Arab countries normalized ties with Israel. Palestinians believe that resistance against occupation is the only way they have to achieve their goals.
People in the besieged Gaza Strip held a rally following the Friday prayers to express their solidarity with Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowing to sacrifice their lives for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Earlier, the Israeli regime forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds, injuring more than 150 worshippers during the second Friday of the fasting holy month of Ramadan. Hamas movement has warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
We are prepared to wage wars for the sake of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will continue to the equation of arms for arms and blood for blood, and that Al-Quds is a red line that must not be crossed. The Israeli occupation will bear full responsibility for any repercussions as a result of its attacks against the worshippers. We are ready for all scenarios to stop this enemy and protect our people.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vow to increase their solidarity with Al-Quds until the removal of all Israeli violations in the holy city.
The Palestinian people are united for the sake of Al-Quds, and we will not abandon Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will fight for the sake of Al-Quds and sacrifice our lives for it.
The Israeli regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression in Al-Quds since the beginning of Ramadan. Palestinian resistance factions warned the Israeli regime of dire consequences if Israeli forces continue to attack Al-Quds.
The Israeli is sending a clear message to the Zionist enemy that it must understand that we will not sit idle while it attacks Al-Quds. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire, and it will only explode in its face.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal enclave say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Heavy stomps of marching soldiers and convoys of Iranian-made weapons paraded in Tehran and across the country on the National Army Day.
All of the four branches of the military took part in the key parade, held at the presence of army officials and Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi. Addressing the ceremony, the president hailed the army's achievements despite the U.S. sanctions.
The defense industry fared the best amid the sanctions atmosphere. The Islamic Republic's army achieved significant capabilities during this period. Not only did the army defend the nation during the Iraqi imposed war on Iran, but it has stood with the people and for the people in all areas.
The parade featured the latest military achievements and weapons produced by the Iranian army, including radars, tanks, armored vehicles, drones, fighter jets, and missiles. This year's highlights were FAT-360 surface-to-surface missile, Labeg precision strike rockets, and Desful and Majid air defense systems. The Islamic Republic says it produces over 80% of its needed military hardware indigenously. In his address to the parade, the Iranian president said the country's show of power sends messages both to friends and enemies.
The preparedness of the army sends the message of hope to the friends of the Islamic Republic. There's also a message to the enemy. The enemy must know that the military might of our armed forces gives us a deterrent power. They must know that the smallest move made against our country and our nation would be monitored by the sharp eyes of our armed forces.
The National Army Day was designated in 1980, following a historic speech by late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. There, he thanked the army for its role in the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution by announcing neutrality in the conflict between the former Pahlavi regime and the revolutionaries.
4 decades of arms embargoes have denied Iran access to even a bullet from other countries. The army says the parades today show that those bans have not harmed Iran's military capability. But in fact, they've been a blessing, since they prompted Iran to build up its own military arsenal so that its security is no longer tied to foreign arms. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
With U.S. President Joe Biden's sagging approval ratings, Democrats' agenda stalled, public discontent over the economy and inflation, and Republicans' strong performance in a series of off-cycle elections, the political landscape in the United States looks grim for the Democratic Party. We now present you an article written by Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled, Wave of U.S. House Democratic Retirement Stokes Fear for Party's Election Prospects. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. For the Michigan Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence, it was a question from her husband, when is our time? For the North Carolina Congressman David Price, it was a judgment that the time has come to step down. Some retiring U.S. Democrats have blamed the gridlock and dysfunction on Capitol Hill, while others point to the redrawing of congressional maps. Still others cite the rise of political extremism and the deteriorating relations between members of Congress, particularly in the wake of 6th of January 2021 insurrection. Announcing his decision to retire last year, the Wisconsin congressman, Ron Kind, was frank. "The truth is, I've run out of gas," he said. The decision not to seek re-election is both deeply personal and political. But as the party braces for a grueling midterm election this November, a rising number of House Democrats are opting not to return to Congress next year. On Monday, the Florida Congressman Ted Deutch announced that he would not seek re-election, bringing the total number of Democratic departures from the House of Representatives so far this cycle to 31. Among them, 8 Democrats are seeking other offices next year, like Tim Ryan of Ohio, who's running for the Senate, and Karen Bass of California, who's running to be mayor of Los Angeles. Some retiring members are powerful veterans, such as Kentucky's John Yarmuth, chair of the Budget Committee, and Oregon's Peter DeFazio, chair of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Others represent politically competitive districts, like Stephanie Murphy of Florida and Ann Kirkpatrick of Arizona. It's a worrying trend for Democrats. Congressional retirements are often an early sign of a wave election for the other party. In 2018, dozens of House Republicans did not seek re-election, including the then House Majority Leader Paul Ryan. The Republican Party lost 41 seats that year, and Democrats gained control of the chamber in an election cycle widely viewed as a referendum on Donald Trump. This year, the political winds are reversed. Republicans are trumpeting each retirement as a sign that Democrats' hopes of keeping their majority are fading. The National Republican Congressional Committee, the NRCC spokesman Mike Berg, said their majority is doomed. Either retire or lose. Though many vacancies are in safely Democratic districts, the rush of retirements among Democrats comes as the party faces significant historical headwinds. The president's party almost always loses seats in the midterm elections, and in the House of Representatives, Democrats can only afford to lose a handful of seats before surrendering control of the House. With Joe Biden's sagging approval ratings, Democrats' agenda stalled, public discontent over the economy and rising inflation, and Republicans' strong performance in a series of off-cycle elections, the political landscape looks grim for the Democratic Party. Adding to the uncertainty is a once-in-a-decade redistricting process when a state's congressional and legislative districts are redrawn. The House of Representatives is often a reflection of the national American mood, which public opinion shows is pessimistic. Voters are frustrated with their political leaders, and the Democratic Party is bracing for a backlash. In polling that asked voters which party they would support on Election Day as opposed to which congressional candidate, Republicans repeatedly hold the edge. In an interview, Price, an 81-year-old, said his decision to leave Congress after 3 decades was mainly personal and not circumstantial. During the Trump years, he said many long-serving Democrats postponed the decision to retire because they believed their experience was needed on Capitol Hill. Now they feel the time is right to retire. Price's new district is rated safely Democratic, and after a long redistricting battle, the North Carolina State Supreme Court recently approved congressional maps that are favorable to the Democratic Party. Kyle Condick, the managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics, said, "The number of retirements is naturally higher in years that end in 2 because those are redistricting cycles." It's been a brutal experience for some. Congressman Jim Cooper witnessed his reliable Democratic Nashville seat being carved up into 3 different districts that Donald Trump would have easily won in 2020. He decried the move as raw politics and an effort to dilute the electoral power of black voters. A day after the Tennessee legislature approved the map, Congressman Jim Cooper announced his retirement from Congress, where he had served for more than three decades. He said, "I explored every possible way, including lawsuits, to stop the gerrymandering and to win one of the three new congressional districts that now divide Nashville." He added, "There's no way, at least for me in this election cycle, but there may be a path for other worthy candidates." John Rogers, a Republican pollster who was the executive director of the National Republican Congressional Committee during the 2018 midterm election cycle, says the retirements of powerful and long-serving Democrats is a strong sign that the Democratic Party is bracing for defeat this November. John Rogers added, "There are too many committee chairs retiring for this to be just about redistricting," adding that the prospect of losing a gavel or ending a lengthy career in the minority was unattractive to some politicians. Retirements deprive a party of the advantages that come with incumbency: fundraising, name recognition, and a deep understanding of their constituency, factors that are especially critical in competitive seats. Kondik, author of The Long Red Thread, How Democratic Dominance Gave Way to Republican Advantage in U.S. House Elections, said, "Incumbency is not as valuable as it used to be, but open seats are generally harder to defend, particularly in a wave-style environment." Not since 1992 have so many House Democrats opted not to seek re-election. And with states still finalizing their congressional maps and candidate filing deadlines approaching, there might be more retirements to come. Kondik said, "However bad it is to serve in Congress, it's worse to serve in the minority, particularly in the House." Notably bucking the trend, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has announced her decision to run again, extinguishing speculation that she would retire at the end of the term. Nancy Pelosi was re-elected as Speaker of the House after agreeing to step down from the role by the end of 2022. The Republican retirements, though far fewer, are also telling. As of this week, 15 House Republicans have said they won't run for re-election, with 7 running for another office. Among them are more moderate members, including Adam Kinzinger of Illinois and John Katko of New York, who have faced conservative backlash for voting to impeach former President Donald Trump. Democrats argue that much could change before the November elections. The COVID-19 pandemic appears to be in retreat, and officials claim the economy remains strong despite inflation. Joe Biden has started to ramp up his travel around the country, touting his legislative accomplishments. He has received rare bipartisan praise from his handling of the crisis in Ukraine, and Democratic voters are excited about his nominee for the Supreme Court, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who is poised to become the first black woman to serve on the Supreme Court bench after a confirmation hearings later this month. And Republicans, they say, will have to answer for Donald Trump's enduring control over their party and the fallout from the congressional investigation into the events of 6th of January 2021, as well as for their efforts to restrict access to abortion and the ballot, issues that Democrats believe will rally voters to their side this cycle. Ian Russell, a Democratic strategist and former national political director with the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, said, "Most midterm elections, by their nature, are referenda on a party of power." But he said that by embracing Donald Trump's lies about election fraud and refusing to sanction their most extreme members, Republicans are helping frame the election as a choice between two parties with very different priorities, only one of which is going to wind up in charge. Last month, Lawrence, the Michigan congresswoman, surprised some of her colleagues when she announced that she would retire at the end of the term, after more than 3 decades in public service. She said in an interview, after 4 years of Donald Trump's administration, the COVID-19 pandemic, 6th of January, it was a death by a million cuts. Lawrence, who represents a heavily Democratic district and is the only black member of Michigan's congressional delegation, said she feels good about her legacy and would continue to be active in her community in other ways. "I'm not going home to plant flowers," she said. She hopes her departure will make room for a new generation of black lawmakers who will bring fresh urgency to the battles over women's reproductive rights, voting protections, and police reform. She said, "I came into Congress when we were in the minority, but I came in with the intent to make a difference, and I hope that continues to motivate American citizens to step up into public service, because there is work to do."
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim philosophers, thinkers, jurists, and scholars all across the world of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Shaykh Mahdavi and Shaykh Ziyaniya. Shaykh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about an outstanding Shiite authority or marja, an influential teacher of the Seminary of Qom, the source of blessing and source of benefit for so many students, and because of his public affairs and public services, so many people of the city of Qom. He is no one but Mirza Javad Tabrizi. Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the early life of Ayatollah Javad Tabrizi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Mirza Javad Tabrizi rahmatullah alayh was born in 1305 according to Hijri solar calendar in Tabriz. And Tabriz is a city that is located in the northwest of Iran. And this city is the city of many famous scholars like Allama Tabatabai rahmatullah alayh, and like Marhum Mirza Jawad Agha Maliki Tabrizi, that was a teacher of akhlaq and ethics, and is different with Mirza Jawad Tabrizi that today we want to discuss about.
Very good.
And many other scholars that are generated and are cultivated from the city of Tabriz. But this famous scholar, I mean Mirza Jawad Tabrizi, was born in Tabriz, and his father was a very famous merchant, and they were wealthy and rich. But besides being rich, they were really faithful and believing. He started his studies when he was 7 years old. Of course, he studied in, you know, modern schools and up to high school. And then, because he was attracted in Islamic studies, he moved to Islamic seminary and studied in Talibiyyah school, Islamic seminary, okay, in Tabriz.
That's right.
Of course, at the beginning of this, you know, decision, his family were standing against his decision, mm-hmm. and they were not agree with him. Because that time was the era that people were not, you know, optimist toward Islamic seminaries. And okay. people were thinking that noble students, those ones who are talented ones, must not enter Islamic seminaries. Mm-hmm. And that is a waste of time.
That's right.
And because Ayatollah Mirza Jawad Tabrizi was from a rich family and there were a famous family, you know, family that was known to many people in Tabriz.
Yes.
His father and his family, they didn't want him to be a clergyman.
Okay.
So they stood against him. But Ayatollah Mirza Jawad Tabrizi convinced his father. And at last he was accepted by his family to be a clergyman.
That's all right. Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh, for your nice elaboration. So the main centers for the study of Ayatollah Jawad Tabrizi were Qom and Najaf al-Ashraf. What about his teachers, Sheikh Mahtavi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In continuation of what my brother said, when he started his study in Qom, for almost 7 years he stayed in Qom. But after a while, he was really in hope and desiring to go to Najaf and stay in Najaf and benefit from the teacher in Najaf. And finally, he succeeded to go there and benefit from Sayyid al-Khuyi, who is regarded as his main teacher. And inshallah, I will go forward and talk about it. But before we go there and talk about his presence in Najaf, there is a nice memory narrated by him on the way that led him to succeed to go to Najaf. He's saying that, "I didn't have any money, I didn't have any hope to be succeeded to go there and apply for the passport because it was the time in which that Iranian coup being led by American had happened during the time of Mossadegh in Iran, 28th of Murdad. So the situation, the political situation of Iran was not good. There was so much pressure and push against the clergymen. So we were not welcome anywhere in the government. So I was sitting in the Faizia next to the courtyard of Faizia, being hopeless, but in hope to get this chance to go there. Suddenly, being under the control of Imam Asr, but as okay. he is saying that, suddenly someone came to me, asked me, "Why are you so sad?" He said, "Actually, nothing has happened. I only have this hope to go to Najaf." All of a sudden, the guy told me, "Okay, no worries. You just leave me your identifications, ID documents." And after a while, he gave me my passport, and I was really happy without losing and missing any time. I went to Iraq, and his main part of his life starts when he meets Ayatollah Sayyid al-Khuyi in that blissful gathering, when at the first time Ayatollah Khuyi approached him by one fiqhi question, which is considered as one of the typical and critical ones, and the way he elaborated on the question made Ayatollah Khuyi to be happy with having such a student. And after a while, he succeeded to be regarded as one of the members in the circle of istifta. So it was not easy to get this chance to be regarded as the member, as an active member in the circle of the istifta of someone like the outstanding marja of Shia, like Sayyid al-Khuyi.
That's right.
He is narrating the time he was forced to leave and depart Iraq because of the pressure of Saddam, the dictator of Iraq, during the time of 1355, almost 2 years before the Iranian revolution.
Okay.
So actually it was a push upon all Iranian talibah who were living in Iraq to leave and depart Iraq.
Yes.
He is saying that Ayatollah Khuyi was really sad about my departure, as if he was losing one of the backbone student among his circle of study. And he was such a student. When we look at his works, being left after his demise. And when we look at his great students nowadays in our seminary school of Qom, now like Ayatollah Shabzindedar and Ayatollah Genji and many of these great ulama.
These were the direct students of Ayatollah Jawad Tabrizi, okay.
Yes. Okay. So we see that Ayatollah Jawad Tabrizi, he was really outstanding marja who left us very soon when he was 80 years old. Usually this age among the circle of the maraji is considered, yes, still we can have maraji being older than this. By the way, now we are benefiting by his legacy in different field of actually having legacy in the field of the social and public services, having legacy in leaving legacy in the field of seminary houses, yes, and students and the works. Alhamdulillah, he had such blissful life.
That's all right. He has also been, Sheikh Ziyaniya, the source of benefit, I mean, in both scholarly aspect of the life and the public services, I mean, in his life. Let's talk a little bit about this. First, let's talk about his publications. What are they?
Okay, there are many books written by late Ayatollah Mirza Jawad Tabrizi, from which we may mention some of them. That is, for example, Irshad al-Talib, that is a four-volume commentary and explanation on the book of Makasib al-Muharram from Sheikh al-Ansari, rahmatullah alayh, and Tabaqat al-Rijal, Takmilat al-Minhaj al-Salihin. He has some books regarding the Fazail of Ahlul Bayt alayhimussalatu wassalam and the griefs that and the Masa'ib that Ahlul Bayt alayhimussalatu wassalam tolerated, like Zulamat Fatimah al-Zahra salamullah alayha, and Ash-Sha'ir al-Husayniyya, Abaqat Wilaiyya, Ziyarat Ashura, that is a pamphlet and book regarding this Ziyarat and supplication. And you know, Kitab al-Fadak also. And one of the important points that I should mention regarding the social activities of late Ayatollah Mirza Jawad Tabrizi is that he was really a devotee of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha, yes, the great daughter of Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And at the day of martyrdom of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha, late Ayatollah Mirza Jawad Tabrizi used to come to the streets and had a demonstration from his house to the shrine of Lady Fatima al-Masuma salamullah alayha.
Especially barefooted.
Yes, barefooted.
There are many pictures on him on website. If you Google Mirza Jawad Tabrizi, Fatima al-Zahra, the first picture that comes on the Google search will be the Ayatollah on the streets of the city of Qom, walking towards the holy shrine of Lady Fatima al-Masuma, but barefooted, you know.
Yeah.
This going barefooted, you know, was a sign of respect, yeah, that he had for Lady Fatima al-Zahra.
So he was really in love of Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha and tried.
Yes.
And he did his best to, you know, publicize the, yes, name of Fatima al-Zahra, yes, salamullah alayha, all around the world.
There are so many maraj like, yes, Ayatollah Wahid Khorasani.
Even Ayatollah Wahid Khorasani, yes, is continuing this sunnah and this, yes, custom.
Okay.
Another important point regarding his social activities is the establishment and constructing the mosques and also schools and even hospitals.
Clinics.
Nowadays,
and hospitals,
we have Baghiyatullah Hospital in Qom that is active,
yes,
yet and is really fruitful for people here. And this hospital is established by late Ayatollah Mirza Jawad Tabrizi. Really? And he had some, you know, associations and some, you know, institutions to help needy people and orphanage and, you know, some activities, yes, like this.
Very good. That's all right. Really a source of benefit and source of blessing, especially for the city of Qom. You know, as you said, the Baghiyatullah Clinic, which is really provided with the modern, you know, facilities and is really helpful for so many people in the city of Qom.
Maybe I may mention one short memory regarding having faith in the support of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When we look at the end of his life, mm-hmm, we should not disregard the moment he started this journey. As he narrates, he says, as I as I left my family, and it was against the wish of my family to become a clergyman, we came to Qom, and we didn't get any support from the family because I was against their wish. So he's saying that I was the student of Hoze with Ayatollah Ja'fari.
Allama Ja'fari, you mean?
Yes. Muhammad Taqi Ja'fari. Allama Muhammad Taqi Ja'fari. And he is saying that days would pass upon us and we didn't have anything to eat.
Oh.
By only having faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that I have this aim to do something for the sake of you, we see how the end of his life happened, that today everybody is speaking good upon him, yes, and yes, his actually final point of his life.
That's all right. That's all right. About his demise, it is documented that it was Aban 29th, 1385, according to the solar calendar, coincidence with Shawwal 28, 1427. The burial prayer was done by Ayatollah Wahid al-Khurasani. May Allah protect him and may Allah prolong his life. And his body was taken into the holy shrine of Lady Fatima to Masuma, and he was buried over there. It is believed that so many maraja and so many personalities from different countries like Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, you know, Lebanon, Syria, and Arabia, you know, were present in the burial procession. And also a message of condolence was sent by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, believing that he was among the most outstanding and prominent asatid or professors, scholars of the House of Qom, who was famous for in both. And he was pious and famous for both among the scholars and also among the youth and the public. And this is truly about the character of Ayatollah Mirza Jawad Tabrizi. He was really an outstanding scholar who was known by both the public and the scholars. May Allah bless his soul, the Ayatollah Mirza Jawad Tabrizi, the author of Irshad al-Talib. Thank you much, Sheikh Ziyania and Sheikh Mahdavi, for his explanation, elaboration on the life of Ayatollah Mirza Jawad Tabrizi. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. You are listening to The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/ and Call of Islam page. Also, YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you. Afi Yaman Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.